Hello, everyone. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show and to Soundbites, our weekly look at food, farming, and our environment. And you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. And we have a really interesting episode coming up in the next hour. We're going to talk about why the European Union decided to ban some American apples because of a pesticide commonly used called DPA. Are their safety concerns overblown? What does it mean for us? We'll hear from a number of different perspectives about that. We'll also hear a very funny story about the battle between the Maryland Transit Authority and a family of ospreys. But first, we're joined by Paul Shapiro, who is Vice President for Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the United States. He recently wrote an op-ed that appeared in the Baltimore Sun called Eat Less Chicken. And Paul, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. It's an honor to be with you.
Eat less chicken. So let's talk about why you're – first of all, the part of the admonition here in your piece had to do with water. That's how you began.
That's right. You know, we just celebrated Earth Day last week, and lots of people were thinking about what we can each do to help conserve the amount of the Earth's resources that we're each using. And while sometimes when we think about conserving water, we may think about things like taking shorter showers or turning the water off when we brush our teeth, sure, those are important to consider, but they pale in comparison to the amount of water that is used to produce meat products, especially chicken. And what a point I made in the op-ed is that if you look at how many gallons of water it takes just to slaughter one chicken, not even to raise the chicken, but just to slaughter the chicken, on a per pound of live weight of animal basis, it's actually more water than for beef cattle slaughter plants or for pig slaughter plants. So every time you go to the supermarket, if you pick up a chicken carcass, put it in your cart, the fact is that you may as well go down to the beverage aisle and get 9 gallons of water just to dump them out, because that's how much water it takes solely to slaughter one chicken. And that's not even including the approximately 1,000 gallons of water that it takes to get that chicken from shell to the slaughter plant in the first place. In other words, if we really want to conserve water, you would do more by not buying that chicken than you would do by not taking a shower for 6 months.
6 months.
Six months. So, and I'm not recommending anybody go without bathing for 6 months, mind you, Mark.
Please, thank you.
Maybe go the easier way. You know? leave the chicken in the supermarket.
So let me ask this question, though, before we talk about leaving chickens in the supermarket, because most of the country, I would imagine, people are omnivores rather than vegetarian or vegan or pescatarian, which is a growing crowd. But why does it take so much more water in the slaughtering processing part of a chicken than it would for any other, for the larger animals, like pigs or cows or the cattle? Why is that?
It largely takes more water because of the way that chickens are immobilized prior to the slaughter process.
What do you mean?
In a chicken slaughter plant, the birds are hung upside down while they're fully conscious. They're then dragged through a vat of electrified water. Their head goes through this vat, which is designed to render them immobile. They become essentially paralyzed so that their necks can then be dragged over a circulating blade. In cattle and pig slaughter plants, they don't have that type of a so-called water stun bath. What they have are other means of stunning animals, like captive bolt guns or electric currents and so on. But in poultry slaughter, the chickens, before being slaughtered, are run through this vat of water. So that's one reason why chicken slaughter is so much more water consumptive than that of other animals.
Well, that's a pretty graphic description. And what effect does this have? What part of your argument is the effect that you're arguing all this has on the issue of water, period? That we have, I mean, we have clearly are in many areas in danger of droughts and in danger of losing aquifers and rain, and that has become minimal in some places and torrential in others. So how does this all affect our ability to use, access, and have water?
It affects it dramatically, Mark. We need to be smarter when it comes to the ways in which we're using water. We need to be less wasteful of water. You know, it's said that the wars of the past are fought over oil, and many of the wars of the future may end up being fought over water. So how can we conserve this precious resource that is diminishing in supply to us? Well, one way is to eat less meat. Much of the meat industry is extremely water thirsty. And so when you look at ways to conserve water, eating less meat really should be at the top of our agenda. In fact, the United Nations runs what's called the World Water Day as a way to try to help people of our planet recognize the ways in which we can each reduce our water usage. And the number one thing that they say is to minimize meat consumption.
I know you mentioned your article that Bittman's piece from the New York Times about vegan till six, meatless Mondays, mm-hmm. because most people are omnivorous in this country, right? I mean, they eat meat.
That's certainly true.
Right? And I know your Humane Society has done a number of campaigns. I saw the one, I think it was you that did, where you asked people to stand inside of a tiny metal cage.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that yours?
Yeah, it is. We did that.
And where you have people just on the street corner and are in this tiny metal cage and ask how it feels, because that's where they put pigs to gestate and have their young.
That's right. We asked people to do what we call the Great Crate Challenge. Basically, what that means is that we have a crate that is designed for a human, in which you get in and you can't even turn around. And you can watch this on YouTube. Just look up Great Crate Challenge. And already about 1.5 million people have viewed it online. But in effect, people get inside of this crate and they're nearly immobilized. And most people can't even take it for 4 minutes. But we ask them, if you couldn't take it for 4 minutes, why is the pork industry subjecting pigs to this type of cruelty for 4 years? It's standard in the pork industry to lock these 500-pound animals, or social, intelligent creatures, inside of cages so small they can't even turn around. We wouldn't subject the most heinous criminals in our society to such mistreatment. Murderers and rapists, we don't put them in cells so small they literally can't even turn around for their entire lives for years on end. Yeah, what crime have pigs in the pork industry committed to deserve such punishment? The only crime they've committed is being born into the wrong species. And that's no justification for torturing them for their entire lives. And that's exactly what the pork industry is doing.
So what was the purpose of the editorial?
Really, the purpose of the editorial is to suggest that if we want to take Earth Day and environmental protection seriously, looking at our food choices is a perfect place to start. Yes, we should be concerned about what coal and oil companies are doing. That's very important. But we also need to be concerned about what we are doing, what type of foods we are putting on our plate, and eating a more earth-friendly diet, which means eating less meat and eating more delicious vegetarian meals. It doesn't necessarily mean that one needs to become a vegan overnight or anything like that. What it does mean, though, is that even doing simple things like taking a vacation from meat one day a week, try a meatless Monday, for example, are great ways to get into eating an animal-friendlier and earth-friendlier diet.
Coming back to this original conversation about the piece you wrote, the amount of water, I mean, this is a really huge issue. And I think that people don't realize what this means for the environment, what it means for our water supplies we were talking about before. And also the way you described it, I mean, it's, you know, I've talked to a friend of mine who, when I read your article, who raises chickens here in the Baltimore area. And he raises a small amount, and they're all free range, and he actually does a number where he does his own blessing and slaughters them by himself before he sells them to the public in a CSA. And I just think about this question people have always, there's a difference for those people who do eat meat and do want to eat and will eat chicken. There's a question that comes, the line is for me between murder and torture. Sometimes I can understand killing, but not torture.
Sure, and I think it's certainly a vast improvement to treat animals well prior to slaughtering them than it is to torture them for their entire life. Prior to slaughtering them. There's no doubt about it. There is a difference, without a doubt. At the same time, we should keep in mind that more than 9 out of 10 animals who are being raised for food are being subjected to quite torturous treatment on factory farms, and that when you go to supermarkets and restaurants, it's nearly all of the meat that is being sold at restaurants and supermarkets in our country. And so for people who are concerned about preventing that type of inhumane treatment, a great place to start is to simply start eating less meat. It doesn't mean you have to eat no meat, but it does mean eating less meat. And yeah, it should mean seeking out alternatives, switching from these most abusive factory farming products to products where the animal's welfare was taken into greater consideration. You're absolutely right.
One of the things I've noticed that you've been writing about has to do with the restrictions on investigative reporters in our food industry. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure, Mark, and it's a very important issue. I'm so glad you brought it up. Organizations like the Humane Society of the United States have been conducting whistleblowing exposés at factory farms and slaughter plants for a good number of years now. And these exposés are showing environmental degradation, animal cruelty that are leading to animal cruelty convictions, meat recalls, slaughter plant shutdowns, and more. And the meat industry's response to these exposés has been not to try to prevent the abuses that are being uncovered, but rather simply to try to prevent the American people from finding out about those abuses in the first place. And they've been pushing bills across the country called ag-gag bills. These bills are intended to criminalize not the cruelty, but the documentation of the cruelty. So, for example, in some states like Utah and Idaho where they passed these, if you are witnessing somebody in an agribusiness facility abusing an animal and you pull out your iPhone to take a photo or a video, that becomes the crime. Some of the bills they put forth would have, had they been enacted, would have even made it illegal simply to possess such photos. So, for example, Mark, if I had taken a photo of animal abuse on a factory farm and I emailed you that photo, if those bills had become law like the meat industry wanted, you would have become a criminal merely for possessing it and an additional crime just to broadcast it over the airwaves. This is an industry, the meat industry, that is desperate. It's grasping at straws to try to keep the American people in the dark about its very sordid track record of animal cruelty, environmental degradation, food safety problems, and more. And ag-gag bills are the perfect example of how much this industry has to hide.
These are localized issues. It's not become a federal issue, or has become a federal issue?
No, these have been all state bills that have been introduced in about 20 different states that have introduced special legislation now.
Well, this has been fascinating. We look forward to having you back, and I think that we'll raise those issues again in a debate format and let you join us for that conversation as well.
I would love that, Mark.
I'm sure you would. So I want to thank you, Paul Shapiro, so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Take care. We're about to have a conversation with Tom Philpott, Mother Jones's food and ag correspondent. He's co-founder of Maverick Farms in Valle Cruces, North Carolina, and wrote an article last week in Mother Jones called Why American Apples Just Got Banned in Europe. And Sonia Lunder joins us. She's senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group. And Sonia Lunder and Tom Philpott, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So, Tom, let's start off this ruckus you're causing now with this article.
Well, I should say that all the credit goes to Environmental Working Group on this one. They got the scoop on, they do this great review every year of pesticide residues on fruits and vegetables. Sonia can tell us more about. They just figured out this year that Europe had just banned, a couple of months ago, very recently, banned most American apples based on a certain pesticide residue that, is showing up at high levels. And I think that is pretty big news to Americans that suddenly an entire continent has decided that the apples that we're eating can't be thought of as safe.
So, Sonia, let's talk a bit about this. I mean, this obviously clearly is controversial. Let's talk about this particular substance that was banned in Europe and was the whole, see if I'm saying this right, diphenylamine, is that right?
Diphenylamine, yeah.
Thank you. But you said it much better than I. Diphenylamine. So this is a coating that goes on apples to keep them looking good, correct?
Basically, yes. Every year we take a close look at the data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that looks at pesticide residues on conventionally grown and organically grown fruits and vegetables after they've been washed pretty thoroughly and trying to get a gauge on how much pesticides people are eating when they eat conventional produce. And apples have topped our list of the crops with the most pesticide residues on them for 4 years straight. And so we take a particularly close look at apples. This year, when I was digging around to see what was new in the world of pesticides, I realized that there are articles in the trade press that apple growers would no longer be able to export their apples to Europe because of the restrictions on diphenylamine. And this was quite a surprise to me because diphenylamine isn't a pesticide in the way you think of something that's put on to kill insects or mold. It's actually a plant growth regulator, which means it just, you know, it serves the purpose of protecting the apple peel when apples are stored and raw, and, you know, they can be in cold storage for months and months, up to 12 months, really, because they're only harvested once a year. And that Europe was really concerned that this, as an amine, could combine with any sources of nitrates or nitrites along the production chain and form nitrosamines. And these are really potent carcinogens in the food supply, something we really think about mostly in bacon and other smoked meats. But if indeed these chemicals are forming, it would be a serious health concern.
So what we're talking, so that would mean, as you were saying, that made me think of this. So if you go to a store and buy, let's say, a Honeycrisp apple, because everybody loves Honeycrisp these days, have something that tastes a little bit different than everything else, and they're organic, but you buy them in midwinter or spring, even though they're organic, they're also coated in this.
No, diphenylamine is technically registered as a pesticide and not allowed to be used on organic fruits. They have to use other mechanisms to store apples and pears, you know, in cold storage for months. And so you wouldn't expect this to be in any significant concentration on organic fruit. But according to the most recent test data we have is from 2010, and diphenylamine was found on almost every conventional apple. And as far as we can tell by reading the trade literature and talking to the extension agents, this is still very common practice for conventionally grown apples. And some pears, it's a lot less frequent with raw pears.
So, but what do we know about this? I mean, why the European Union banned it in terms of what the science is saying? I mean, about the amount used and how dangerous it is for human consumption.
Yeah, well, this is a really interesting case for us because Europe, like the U.S., is required to periodically re-register and reassess the safety of pesticides, and this is to take into account our evolving understanding of what's toxic and what's safe. And under that process, actually years ago in 2008, Europe started looking at diphenylamine and realized that there was this possibility, based on the science, based on its chemical structure, that nitrosamines could be forming, either when you have mixtures of pesticides ready to spray on the apples or when the apples are in storage or also when they were made into applesauce or apple juice. And so it asked for more specific data from the diphenylamine pesticide producers. And the industry submitted some data, and they found some breakdown of the DPA on stored fruit, and they couldn't rule out the possibility that this was a nitrosamine. And the concentrations are in the part per billion range, but actually for a type of bacon in the United States, it's a high risk for nitrosamine formation. The USDA actually requires all that bacon to be tested, and any concentrations greater than 10 part per billion mean that the bacon can't be sold for human consumption. So we have a precedent that concentrations of nitrosamines in that part per billion range would actually be illegal in other types of food. And an indication that if these nitrosamines are indeed forming, that would be a significant health concern. Now, Europe took action based on the data gap, based on the fact that they couldn't rule out the formation of cancer-causing chemicals. And I'm sure, as Tom would agree, this is really different than what we'd expect to happen in the U.S., where there seems to be a higher level of proof required to actually ban chemicals, both pesticides and any other type of toxic chemical that I've encountered as a public health advocate.
Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the case really illustrates between the United States and Europe is the use of the precautionary principle. And that's a pretty common sense principle. When you get the idea that there's a high level of risk, it's pretty common sense to take precautions from doing that activity. Like you wouldn't take an idle drive at 1 a.m. on New Year's Eve, you know, on the morning, you know, 1 a.m. after New Year's Eve. You know, there's lots of cops in the road. There's drunk drivers in the road. You would go somewhere if you needed to, but if you didn't have to, you wouldn't do it. And that's basically the precautionary principle. And the European Union does recognize it as a way to manage pesticides. And so they saw the potential for a risk. They asked the companies for data to show that it wasn't a risk. And as the Environmental Working Group showed, the companies had 4 years to come up with data, and they came up with a study that did not rule out the possibility at all of a risk from this product. And so Europe banned it pending further information. If the companies can come up with information that this chemical transformation that it's talking about doesn't happen, then it could come back on the market. In the U.S., it is a long, drawn-out process, and the possibility of risk, the fact that there's no data that backs up the idea that there's not risk, isn't enough to move authorities, unfortunately. So it's like saying, well, you know, it's 1 a.m., New Year's Eve just happened, let's just hop in the car for a little drive.
But is there some controversy over this? I mean, I read something, I think, where was I? Actually, I think something you wrote, Sonia, where the World Health Organization did not support banning it. They think that they weren't sure that I think the quote you have in here was unlikely to present a public health concern. I mean, so I mean, is there a question about the science and how dangerous this is or not?
Well, no one can prove that these treatments are safe. No one can say conclusively that we're not forming carcinogens on the outside of apples before we put them in storage or while they're being stored. So the question really comes down to what people feel like doing in the face of this uncertainty. And you know, I think it's important to note here that the precautionary principle isn't just sunshine and rainbows, but this is the fact that this is a chemical structure that we know in other foods can lend to the formation of carcinogens. And there's no debate about the fact that nitrosamines cause cancer in animals, and people who eat them, higher concentrations of nitrosamine-contaminated foods, have higher rates of cancer. So, then it becomes an issue of, you know, what's an acceptable risk. And when I look at these two systems of assessing pesticide safety, I think it's also important to note that the EPA was totally unaware of what was happening in Europe. So not only do they require a higher level of evidence to take action, but they don't even have they don't appear to have their sleuths out looking at new data that's being generated to guarantee the safety of pesticides in Europe and feeding that information back into the EPA system of keeping an eye on pesticides and new developments and new toxicity concerns. But when I look at these two systems, I would prefer to eat apples, that are regulated by a government body that takes my health and these potential risks much more seriously.
I think in one of the reports it was written, it said earlier this year, three scientists in the U.S. EPA Office of Pesticides, which is tasked with pesticide safety reviews, told your group, the Environmental Working Group, that they were unaware of the new European bans, which you were just talking about, and import restrictions. But they had no plans to reassess this in light of European action. So, and then you have the industry and the Alliance for Food and Farming. This is one of their quotes, and let's talk about it a minute. One of the things they say is the Environmental Working Group is once again scaring consumers about an extremely safe and healthy product that parents should be feeding their children more for good health, and that monitoring this compound is regularly conducted by the Department of Agriculture and their pesticide data program, and found it well below tolerance levels. More than 60 countries in WHO have found this compound safe, according to stringent regulations. So they're not with us today, but if they were here, they'd be saying that as well. So how would you respond to that?
Well, so the U.S. tolerance level, the maximum allowable amount of this pesticide on apples is 10 parts per million, and Europe recently dropped that 100-fold to 0.1 part per million. They're saying we don't want this residue on the food that we're feeding our citizens until we can prove that it's not contaminated with carcinogenic breakdown products. So the press release is sidestepping the European action, completely not responding to it. And, we've seen that EPA is not aware of or considering this new evidence of the breakdown products. And so I think it's just kind of an incomplete response to the points we're raising.
Well, the Environmental Watch group that you represent is all through their report, their Alliance for Food and Farming, saying that even you say and have stated that a diet rich in fruits and vegetables far outweighs any risks of residues that may be present.
We know that people who eat more fruits and vegetables are generally healthier and have better long-term health trends. I don't think that's any excuse for not taking a close look at pesticide residues and ensuring that the fruits and vegetables we're selling Americans and encouraging them to eat are as safe and healthy as possible.
So what you're saying, I guess, and I'll just be clear, are you suggesting we should kind of ban the use of this at the moment in America, or the EPA should launch a study to tell us what's really going on?
Well, we've written to the EPA pesticide office, and we've actually asked for a temporary restriction on using this pesticide treatment until EPA has data to prove that it's safe, and that means that nitrosamines are not forming at concentrations that would be not allowed in bacon or other types of meat.
That was Sonia Lunder, senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group. You also heard from Tom Philpott, food and ag correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear the rest of my interview with Lunder and Philpott, and also hear two different perspectives on this very same issue. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. Today on the program, we're talking about the European Union's ban on certain apples from the United States that are coated with a pesticide called DPA. I'm here with Sonia Lunder, senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group, and Tom Philpott, the food and ag correspondent for Mother Jones. Tom, I'm curious about one thing about the politics of EPA at the moment and how you analyze where we are with the Environmental Protection Agency when it comes to situations like this.
Well, we are in a point where we've been for a long time now where the agency has pretty minimal oversight of these chemicals. They rely on the industry to test them. And we've seen over and over again in other cases that when evidence of harm comes up, another big case is the herbicide atrazine, where there is a pretty big amount of evidence that atrazine in low doses in water, where it's shown up over and over again in the Midwest, is causing all kinds of problems, potential cancers, reproductive problems. In Europe, once again, banned atrazine, I think I'm right to say, 10 or so years ago.
Right.
And the EPA is on this long, slow, painstaking process of reconsidering it, gathering data. Meanwhile, it's being used every year, year in and year out. I don't expect them to ever ban it. I think they would have banned it by now if they're going to. So we have a situation where industry and the interests of industry are taking it extremely seriously, and potential problems, especially the sort of subtle chronic problems you get from ingesting carcinogens in a little level one apple, potentially, or you get a few parts per billion concentration of atrazine in drinking water. They're really, really, really bad at parsing those risks. Because it's hard, you can't tie a single cancer to a single apple. These are long-term effects that are impossible to tie down. But you can show at a population level that when people are exposed to this stuff, cancer rates rise, things like that. And the EPA is really, really bad at doing anything about stuff like that.
So I'm curious, Sonia, if you know what happens in Europe. Europe is also, as America, at a different level, but a market-driven economy, and with private agriculture that sells their product all year round. So and sells apples all year round. So what do they use in Europe that keeps the apples fresh and appealing to the consumer's eye that we don't do here?
Well, there are alternative chemical treatments. There are two of them, and we didn't look in detail to see what the toxicity concerns of those might be. But we also know that organic producers are not allowed to use most synthetic substances on their food. So you can modify the storage conditions. They store them at specific temperatures, and really playing with a concentration of oxygen and nitrogen and other gases in the air to try to inhibit it. And maybe you can't store apples for 12 months and eat them. Maybe we need to shift to a diet that's less dependent on storage, long-term storage of fruits and vegetables, and eating more in season. In Europe, they're generally eating the same foods, produce that we are. They're maybe importing it from slightly different countries, but the pesticides the pesticide industry is a global industry, so the pesticide residues that they're considering are similar, if not identical, to those that we're looking at in the United States. You'd think there'd be better harmonization and feedback between the new data that's generated to prove the safety of chemicals in one regulatory regime and another.
Yeah, as I was thinking about that, the reason I asked that question is in a very personal way, but also for many people who shop for apples 12 months a year, as I do, and pick up these organic apples that here in the month of April, when they must have been harvested last September, October, November, wherever they were harvested from. Mm-hmm. So I asked that question because there must be alternative ways of keeping these apples if organic apples are not allowed to use this kind of these kind of chemicals to preserve them. So that's why I was asking. Obviously, there are other ways to do this that don't use chemicals like this.
Right.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us. This has been very fascinating. Taking your time with us today is great for both of you. Sonia Lunder, who you just heard, is senior analyst with the Environmental Working Group. And at steinershow.org, we will be linking to her articles that she's been writing, as well as the ones by Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and ag correspondent, who joined us here and wrote this article, Why American Apples Just Got Banned in Europe. That'll be there on our site, as well as the EWG, and also the statements from App Alliance for Food and Farming and the industry as well will all be there on our website. Thank you both so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Thank you both.
We're about to have a conversation with Marilyn Dolan, who is Executive Director of the Alliance for Food and Farming, as we continue our look at diphenylamine, or DPA, and the controversy surrounding it here and in Europe. And Marilyn Dolan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is interesting. I mean, we've been reading about this in magazines and been talking to people about it, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us today. And I read what your organization put out as well. So give me just your overall take on this DPA ban and what people would like the EPA to do to take another look at it, and your perspective on that, generally speaking, first.
Well, first of all, our organization, the Alliance for Food and Farming, we do a lot of work in trying to get people more information about the safety of their food, particularly when it comes to pesticide residues. DPA is a pesticide that is registered for use on apples and other tree fruits, and it has been determined by the EPA for many years to be very, very safe. In fact, there are over 60 countries and the World Health Organization who are already accepting the use of this pesticide on apples and have determined it to be very safe when it is used properly and under the strict regulations that are required of farmers in the United States.
Let's look at what's going on right now with the European Union's ban on any apples that with DPA being imported into any European country. Let me just start with the economics of it. I mean, the one piece I read from the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, was that this could cost apple growers up to $20 million in exports to Europe. That was put out by the Foreign Agricultural Service. And so that's a big number. I mean, I don't know the entire number in terms of the income of our apple industry, but even if, you know, that's a significant amount of money, is that alone not worth taking a second look?
I honestly can't really speak to very well the economic impact. Our organization deals mainly with the safety of a product. And I think what concerns us the most here is the fact that one country is taking another look at this pesticide is fine, and we certainly encourage anybody to do that if they would like to. But what we really take exception to is the fact that the way this is being communicated by the Environmental Working Group is that apples are not safe. And the fact of the matter is that apples are very safe. And if people in the United States start to believe that they are not safe, now we're talking about something that can impact a lot of people, including farmers, but also consumers, because the fact of the matter is that apples are one of the healthiest things that a consumer can eat, and we do not believe that it is in the best interest of consumers or an activist group to scare people about the foods that they feed their children every day.
One of the things that I think that they in talking to them, that they called for, the Environmental Working Group called for, was that they said they're looking for another EPA review. They said that the Food Quality Protection Act says that you should do one every 15 years, and that that was last reviewed in 1998, which is 16 years ago. And just as a matter of course, that this chemical should be reviewed, especially given what's going on with the European Union, it might be better for the U.S. to get ahead of this and do its own quality investigation.
The fact that the EPA is required to review pesticides should tell people something, and that is that the United States has a very strict regulatory process that governs the safety and the safe use of pesticides. So the information that we actually had was that this pesticide wasn't due to be reviewed until 2022. But again, I think the point we're trying to make is that it is regulated, is highly regulated, and the EPA, if they see there is a need, will look at it, and even if they don't feel there's a need, they will be looking at it again.
I mean, but since the reality is the European Union has said no, I mean, how's that going to affect our farms and our farmers?
Well, it has. That has already impacted the farmers. As I understand it, the European Union isn't a huge market for apples, but it is a market, and they never want to lose a market. So they're dealing with that and working with the European Union. And as I also understand it, the situation isn't so much a concern about safety. It's about getting more data and more information from the manufacturer of the pesticide.
One of the things that we were reading, and again, I'm just curious as to your take on it, was the Europeans are theorizing that the nitrosamines could be generated by DPA. They're not sure how, maybe during storage or when it's processed or hitting other elements. And that is a cancer-causing agent that people find in bacon and other places. And that was one of the reasons that the Europeans said that that they were banning it and saying that what they've seen in the studies they've seen coming from the company that produces DPA didn't go deep enough. And that's until they can resolve that, they didn't want to use this on apples or any products.
I believe that that is the case, but I think that what you said was interesting in that they need more information. I don't think that what they said was that it's not safe. And I think there was some debate on whether or not this pesticide breaks down into a carcinogen, which they aren't sure about. So to go that it is saying that it is, go so far as saying it is not safe, I don't think is accurate. It's that they wanted some more information to prove that it is safe.
You know, when you look at this, one of the questions that people have just about this whole process of what we use to keep our apples fresh. I asked a question about this earlier, which was if you buy, let's say, an organic Honeycrisp apple, you buy it and it now is in April. Well, they obviously harvest in the fall. So what you're seeing is an apple that was harvested many months back, but has been kept fresh with a combination of nitrogen, oxygen, and temperature levels, and then you buy it in the store. So when I was thinking about that and asking that question, it led me to the next kind of natural question is then why, if you can regulate selling organic apples without using this, why use it at all?
I believe that the situation with organic apples is, first of all, there aren't as many of them.
No, that's
so
true.
They are often sold quicker, more quickly than the conventionally grown ones. But they also take advantage of different storage systems, things like controlled atmosphere, where they don't need to have this product applied to them. And I think that I do know that this pesticide is not applied even to 100% of all conventional apples. So not everyone is using that pesticide.
Given the kind of uncertainty, and going back to where we started, given the uncertainty, and this is not saying you shouldn't use DPA if DPA is totally harmless, but it just seems to me that when people ask that question of our government agencies, that there should be a response for the American people, not like saying, oh, don't eat this apple, but to really know what's going on, that we should know what's going on.
Totally agree with that. And I think that is our problem, is that what we were seeing the environmental working group doing was telling people, don't eat that apple. And that's the part that we disagree with, because there have been many, many, many safety tests done on this pesticide. And what the U.S. EPA has found is that it is safe to use. That is what is the real thing that consumers need to know. If we want to look at it again, and the EPA has said it will look at it again, they will do so. But right now, there really isn't any need to be saying that this pesticide is not safe, and more importantly, that conventionally grown apples are not safe, because they are.
Well, I guess when you have the Department of Agriculture and EPA seemingly saying very different things, I mean that's why people, I think, are asking the question beyond what either the industry, what you say as an industry group, or what EWG says as an environmental group. Just as a consumer, we should be able to understand the difference between how the Europeans take it and how we look at it and what the reality is, so we can make a decision on what to buy and what to use and not to use.
It's really important, I think, for consumers to look at something that is done by the U.S. Department of Food and Agriculture every year. It's a report called the Pesticide Data Program, where they go out and they sample products, fruits and vegetables that are often eaten by children, and monitor them for the pesticide residues that they have on them. This report can be found on the USDA's website, and there's a great summary of it called What Consumers Should Know. This report has been done for the past 20 years, and what they consistently find is that pesticide residues found on any of the fruits and vegetables sold in the United States are extremely, extremely low, well below any kinds of safety measures that have been set. And this is something that the USDA, as I said, has been doing for 20 years. This EPA is just one of the pesticides that they monitor for, and they have not found it to be at unsafe levels.
Right. And I guess the question people had is the interaction of that, of DPA with the amount of DPA is the we use is higher than the European Union would use, and B, the question of the interaction with other chemicals, other pesticides, and with the way it's stored in contact with certain natural things in the atmosphere. That's what people are worried about when it comes to that, I think, and the possibility of it releasing nitrosamines,
Well, this is actually what I'm saying, is that I think consumers should feel confident that the U.S. regulatory system is protecting them from anything that would be unsafe, even when it is used in combination with other pesticides or it's been stored for a period of time. They are finding that this product is safe. In fact, there is a researcher by the name of Dr. Carl Winter, who works with the University of California. He provided us with a report last week that shows that the USDA is finding DPA at levels that are 208 times below the safety level that has been determined by the EPA. That's regularly what they find, 208 times lower than what has been determined to be safe.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today with our listeners here. Marilyn Dolan is Executive Director of the Alliance for Food and Farming. As we continue our look at DPA, thank you so much, Marilyn Dolan, for taking the time in your busy schedule to join us.
Okay, thank you.
The Environmental Protection Agency contacted producer Stephanie Mavronis to say they could not provide anyone for our interviews today, but they did give us this statement. He said the EPA will obtain and review the basis of the European Union action on apples and pears and determine whether there's evidence that merits further action in the United States. Although it's been reported that the European Union did not have sufficient information to confirm the safety of EPA-treated apples, in the U.S., we did have sufficient information to make a safety finding. EPA updated its 1997 assessment of DPA in 2005, which included consideration of nitrosamines, and reaffirmed our conclusion that the residues of DPA in apples meet the safety standards of reasonable certainty of no harm. In September 1997, EPA had reevaluated the registration of difenylamine and associated tolerances, allowable residues on food, and had found that the registration and allowable residues met the statutory standard of reasonable certainty of no harm. Difenylamine, which is DPA, is scheduled to be examined in our ongoing registration review program, which ensures that pesticides do not cause unreasonable risks to human health, workers, or the environment. However, if at any time we receive new data about risks posted by a pesticide, the agency will move quickly to take appropriate regulatory action. That was a statement from the EPA. Now we're about to talk to our friend Tim Wheeler, who, of course, is the reporter for Be More Green, the Sun's environmental blog, joins us often here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. Tim, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
So I understand that we almost had a situation in Maryland where we had a pair of ospreys that could have been arrested.
Well, they were trespassing. There's no question about it. These ospreys were trying to set up housekeeping on top of one of the steel gantries that holds the traffic signs on the approaches to the Bay Bridge in Annapolis, right over US 50.
So did they sit in front of these cameras that might have protected us from getting a ticket?
I don't think these get you a ticket. These are the ones that sort of just keep an eye on traffic. If you are trying to figure out whether you're whether you want to wait before you head to the shore or not, you look at these and see how big the backup is. And they initially set up housekeeping. They started building a nest in front of the camera that points at the bridge from the eastbound lanes of US 50. This was, like, I guess, a little over a week before last. And they were busily building away, and the nest, if you've seen osprey nests, they can build quite a sort of substantial home a McMansion, if you will. And this one was starting to encroach on the camera's view. And when the bird was in the nest, it definitely blocked the view. There were a couple of interesting screen grabs I saw where the bird's like peering at the lens, you know. So or it's that close, it appears to be. Let's not give it too much credit.
So now, how did you stumble onto this story?
Well, you know, my good friends that I give them credit, WTOP, were on this thing from the get-go, I suspect because they probably check those traffic cameras often during the day just to give their traffic reports. You know, the news radio station in Washington. They had a live blog about it, and it started to go viral, and it was on the web, and heard about it, you know, the first of last week, and began to check it. By that time, the Maryland Transportation Authority manages the Bay Bridge and the other toll facilities. You know, they sprang into action when the nest was starting to, and the birds were blocking their view, and they took it down on that Friday before. By the beginning of the next week, the birds were back and were building another nest, and that was taken down. And then on Tuesday of last week, Earth Day, if you will, they were back, and again the authority took the nest down. So three times. And the birds were you know, up to that point, they were pretty stubborn. And that's about the point when I jumped on it and wrote about it. And that story also captured a lot of attention. The following day, I'm trying to think, Wednesday, there was no activity at that camera. It was a pretty windy day. And there had been a stick still sitting there, or a new stick, at the end of Tuesday, which led me to think that they had not given up yet. But that stick was gone Wednesday, so I thought maybe nothing more has happened. And then I was out on another assignment. I got an email from a colleague who was checking the cameras, and she looked at the camera pointing westbound on the other side of the highway, and she said they're back at it. And sure enough, you could look on the camera and see another stick laying on the gantry in front of the camera, pointing out, good-sized stick. It didn't just fly up there. By Thursday morning, you know, by 8 o'clock or thereabouts when I looked in, those birds had built up quite a nest, and they were back at it for their fourth try along the way. Now, the Transportation Authority, you know, after three run-ins with these birds and wondering if they were ever going to be rid of them, they consulted, of course, before they ditched the nest with the Fish and Wildlife Service. Ospreys are no longer protected under the Endangered Species Act because they have bounced back from the pesticide poisoning that put them in a real tailspin, pardon the expression, back in the 60s and early 70s. But they had gradually rebounded in numbers since the pesticide DDT was banned. And today they're fairly widespread around the bay, and they're no longer listed as either endangered or threatened, but they are still protected as migratory birds under federal law. So you can't shoot them, and you can't really, you know, harm them or chase off, and you can't destroy their nests, especially if they have eggs in it. So the Fish and Wildlife Service gave them the blessing to remove the nest as long as there were no eggs in it, so as long as they were not actually harming any birds or birds to be. And since the birds were still in the nest building stage, so they don't really, you know, get into laying the eggs till the nest is done. Smart birds that they are. they don't get ahead of themselves. So there were no eggs, and they kept taking them down. But after three tries, they were starting to get some feedback from people who were saying, you're going to have to do something because these birds don't give up. They are one determined bird. One of the biologists I talked to said, you know, they could come back seven or eight times at least before they get the message. So they consulted with the Fish and Wildlife Service again, and one of their biologists came down, looked at the situation, talked to the staff, and recommended to them said the best thing you could do is just simply build them an alternative spot to nest close by. And, you know, ideally you move the material you took out of their nest, their sticks and branches, put them in this new location on this platform, and they will, he said, they'll take right to it. He sounded very confident when I got caught up. You know, he called me back and sort of relayed the advice he gave them, and he made it sound like it was pretty much a sure thing if it happened. And it was interesting to see what happened then, because Thursday morning, by Wednesday, when they started to see signs of nest building on the other side of the highway, the Transportation Authority, like many bureaucracies, had, you know, they had to consult various people before they could actually do anything, see, after they got this recommendation. So they were consulting with their engineers, and they were going to check back with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And then when there were signs that the nest was going up for the fourth time, one of their carpenters got the word to get started building this nest platform right away. And it's not very complicated. It's a thick piece of wood, like plywood, 4x4 with sides on it, you know, a few inches high. Put together pretty firmly. I don't think they had a permit or needed one under the circumstances. And then, you know, by Thursday morning when the nest was you know, going strong, they determined they could put it up and anchor it pretty well so that it wouldn't blow down, and they were going to move it over to the side of the highway over the shoulder so if anything fell out of it, it wouldn't land on vehicles passing by below or possibly cause any traffic accidents. So a little after rush hour on Thursday morning, they went out there with a bucket truck and went up there and attached this platform and then grabbed the nest. The birds, of course, departed whenever they stay away whenever people are around, and put the jumble of sticks and whatnot in the box and went away, pulled off to a certain distance. And they said one of the ospreys came back pretty much right away and landed on it, checked it out.
Now, are they going to move these cameras around so you can watch the ospreys? Are they still doing that? So
yes. It's.
I'm looking at it right now. Right now, I just see traffic, so they're not showing
it's just the traffic. Well, yeah. They're doing it on a reliable basis only Monday through Thursday at noon.
Oh, Monday through Thursday at noon, we can go
it's kind of like instead of soap operas, you can tune into As the Birds Nest instead of As the World Turns.
As the Birds Nest. Just go to chart.state.md.us. Traffic info / traffic cams.
And you want to look at the N1, gantry N1 camera in the Annapolis sector. It's the westbound camera on Route 50. And for 15 minutes or so, 4 days a week, they will turn that camera sideways to look at the box. They were doing it sort of ad hoc on Friday. I actually checked in and saw the birds there, or a bird, on the nest for a while.
So, you know, that means our listeners right now, if you're listening to this at WEA, you can just, in a couple hours, just pop up at noon and see it. Those tomorrow at 9, go see it at noon. And those listening at 6 o'clock on Wednesday night, they can go see it the next day at noon.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, so because you can't really, I mean, it's hard to tell an osprey not to build a nest. When they want to lay their eggs, they want the nest, they want it there, and they're going to have it. So did you climb up to the top of the bridge to talk to the ospreys? Because you're a good reporter, and you're supposed to balance these things out.
Well, I'm afraid the ospreys could not be reached for comment, as I reported in the paper.
I was just trying to push the envelope here.
I went down there with a photographer to catch this. We got there a little, you know, I mean, they were too quick with the box. We were rushing down there, and they had it up within 20, 30 minutes. So by the time we got there, it was already up. But the birds were coming and going at that time. The photographer approached within, you know, less than 100 yards, I would guess, and was able to get some shots. We were, you know, well below at the gantries, I want to say 25 or 30 feet, maybe more, up above the highway there. So I was not going to go climbing that. They didn't give us permission to do that. They told us we could stand on the grassy strip there and watch them, and we did for a while. So that's as good as we're going to get for right now. And I would advise motorists, you know, that the best thing for you is to watch it on the camera as well, because you know, you're not going to be able to see much from the highway, and your fellow motorists might not appreciate it if you slowed down to a crawl.
Just
or
check
pulled
it
off. Yeah.
Check it out at noon on the web. You can do it. Tim Wheeler, the man who puts together Be More Green for the Baltimore Sun, the great Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Tim, thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.